Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, and the Libertarian is Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, coronavirus and the law. And Richard, this week we seem to have kind of hit an inflection point with the coronavirus. This has been a concern, of course, since we first saw the reports out of China about the disease a couple of months ago. But now you're seeing outbreaks in Italy, in Iran. There are reports now about a case in California that may be the first time we've seen the disease spread within the United States. All the other confirmed American cases were started overseas. American markets seem to be rattled. And there have been some mixed signals on this from the administration. The other day, you had people in the White House playing this down while the CDC was warning people that this could get worse. So there's a lot of things to talk about here. Let's start with this one. In just the past few days, I've seen two locations, Costa Mesa, California, and Anniston, Alabama, where the communities and officials and local governments have revolted at the idea of having to host the people who were in quarantine. And in the case of Costa Mesa, the city is going to court to attempt to prevent the state from housing those patients there. Richard, how much leeway does a city or a locality have to assert itself in a case like this?
This is a question that nobody knows the answer to. The usual questions that are raised with respect to quarantines and the like are whether or not any individual who's subject to the inconveniences that they impose will be entitled to have some redress against the state. And the answer in those cases, for the most part, is no, they will not, because the imperative nature of the situation is so great that all traditional conceptions of individual liberty are generally swept aside, and you can essentially imprison people in their own homes under the name of a quarantine, not let them out, not let anybody in. But I am not aware of any particular cases in which you get yourself a battle between two jurisdictions as to where it is that this particular thing should be housed. Folks in the city of Costa Mesa will say, why is it that you want to move people to this population center where the risk to our citizens are going to be far greater by virtue of the fact that we know that with all epidemics, if you contain 99% of the risk, the other 1% could spread and quickly multiply in terms of its effects, so that by the time you're done, you've got yourself a full-scale crisis. The state's going to come back and they're going to say, oh, this is a very interesting point. But no matter where we put people who are under this kind of condition, if we try to separate them, there's going to be exactly the same risk. And so if we don't do it in Costa Mesa or in a given city in Alabama, then we're going to have to do it somewhere else at some particular time. Generally speaking, the legal position is that a city or a county is an artificial instrumentality of the state, and it essentially can dictate the creation and non-creation of these instances. And so probably the presumption is going to be in favor that the state power will prevail. But in this particular case, I do not think that this presumption is going to be anything close to ironclad. I mean, so suppose somebody was able to show that this is a very bad population, a very large population center, and a very high degree of risk, and they identify other locations in other part of the states in which the risk are going to be proportionately lower and the cost are going to be no greater. At that particular point, some judge may come back and say, look, you know, the interest of public safety is by and large given as a first matter to local governments to decide. But here we have a dispute between governments, and we think the evidence is very compelling that the state is picking a position in which the aggregate damages are going to be greater here than they are anywhere else. So it would be one thing for somebody to say, look, we don't want this stuff coming in here. So there's no other place where it can go. And it's another thing for them to say, we don't want it to come in here because there are better places in which it's to go. My guess is that's the way in which this thing ought to play out. But my confidence level as a predictive matter is very, very low, because what always happens under these circumstances is at the last moment there's some odd complication, political or medical, which intervenes and it makes it extremely difficult to figure out what's going to happen. One of the things that we know about epidemics is they're fast moving at the speed of an airplane. Maybe sometimes at the speed even faster than that, if they're blown here, there, or the other place. And so it's very clear that this thing is extremely serious and it's not going away. And I just looked again and the stock market is again clobbered. It's been down basically 10% over the last week. And none of this is because of economic condition. This is economic conditions of the virus. This is essentially an epidemic kind of response, and given the huge interconnectedness within the world, everybody's afraid that you cannot localize this. Nobody is safe, and so therefore the entire stock market and everything else is taking a beating.
So, Richard, the federal government has imposed a mandatory 2-week quarantine period for people who have traveled to the province in China that is at the center of this outbreak. This, thankfully, is not an area of law that we have to examine very often, but you mentioned how wide those powers are a moment ago. Can you just give us the breakdown? From whence does the federal government get the power to quarantine people, even against their will, and are there any limits on it?
Well, I mean, the answer is yes, there are limits on it in some sense, but the answer is they're not very great. Where does the federal government get this power? Well, I think the answer is normally this was regarded as a state issue if you're starting to figure out the way in which the Constitution was originally designed. Indeed, the entire federal government's ability to control immigration into the United States is very weakly defined under the Constitution. But what happens is there is a kind of a maxim that dates back to Roman law that the public safety, and here we really do mean safety and health, is the primary position of a government. And if it turns out that there's no lower entity, no state, no city that could possibly handle this kind of problem, since the federal government has plenary power over immigration at this particular point and pushes aside all state things to the contrary, that power is not only the power to admit, but it's the power to exclude. Many of the people coming back into the United States are, of course, United States citizens, so this is not a question of legality and their right to be here, but it's the health and safety issue. And so the question that a court is going to ask is, first of all, is this a reasonable response to the question of what's going on, or is there something by way of hanky-panky that's playing here? And if these people were in Wuhan, China, or some similar place where many people had already died, and somebody says, we have to basically quarantine them so we know that they're not carrying the virus, and 2 weeks is the medically indicated time, there's going to be no court in the land, regardless of political affiliation or orientation, that's going to treat that as an unreasonable regulation. When I taught some of this stuff many years ago, I used to refer to a case called Juho against the city of San Francisco. And this was the case involving a Chinese person who was trying to get in and out of the city when they declared an epidemic. And the reason that this was regarded as a trade regulation is what they did under this rule is they said that the Chinese could not leave the Chinese quarter in San Francisco, but white people could go in and out of the city and in and out of that particular quarter. So that's not a quarantine, right? And that therefore became a trade restriction. And what they did is they struck that down. We are not within 1,000 miles in this particular case of that particular problem, not very, very close. And so as far as I can see, there's going to be no serious constitutional challenge to the propriety of running quarantine, and there's going to be no real effort in this particular case to say that what they're doing this is for some illegal, illicit, or covert purposes. So I am convinced that this will not only withstand legal challenge, it's so strong a case that there won't be any illegal challenge to begin with.
It can be easy in the abstract to say in situations like this, well, you know, the government just needs to act out of an excess of caution. But when you get to the specifics, the cost-benefit calculation can be pretty complicated. So for instance, there's obviously a theoretical point at which you'd want to shut down travel to at least to certain hotspots for the disease. But if you're too quick to do that, you could be seriously impeding commerce. You could needlessly be creating more panic. How should policymakers be thinking about navigating those risks in a high-stakes circumstance like this?
Oh, my God. Why are you asking such hard questions? You know, essentially what happens is there's no market mechanism that will solve this particular problem by way of buying and trading. And so the only way in which you're going to get legitimacy out of this particular process is for people to be confident that the people in government who are doing this meet a couple of standards. One, they have to be people who are versed and knowledgeable with respect to the kinds of problems that are going on. There are epidemiologists who know more about this than other people, and you'd want them to be consulted. I'm not sure it's a particularly wise move on the part of the president to say that Mike Pence is in charge of this. He's just a random individual when it comes to the question of knowledge on this subject. And it's going to have to be pretty clear that they're going to have to bring somebody in who has real expertise in the subject matter in dealing with health issues generally. It's not even clear that this is the kind of person who's very useful, say, at the FDA. You're not trying to figure out what the risks are of bringing a new cancer drug onto the market. You're trying to deal with a completely different kind of phenomenon. And so you have to get people there. The second thing I think that you have to do is, when you get the right people there, is there cannot be anything other than complete transparency about the way in which this particular debate is going to be covered. You certainly don't want panic to take place, but you have to get an enormous amount of public buy-in for these things, because the legitimacy of these restrictions is going to be tested immediately, because the gravity of the restrictions is such that people will generally want to know answers. So what you need to have is a deliberative process informed by really strong scientific information. And then what you have to do is you have to get political leaders from all parts of the spectrum to come forward and to sort of back this effort, on the grounds that epidemics don't play favors with anybody from one particular party, one particular race, one particular region, anything else of the sort. Can you do it? I think it's very, very hard to do it. And, you know, these turns can take very strange ways. And God knows you could get an even greater cancer difficulty. One of the so-called nice things about this is that there is a tendency, when people are aware of the particular danger, for the successive iterations of the virus to become less rather than more severe. So if you want to think back to another kind of situation, which we had, which will never provoke this kind of response, I could still recall the way in which people responded to AIDS, you know, 1981 and so. And there was a sort of a widespread panic about what was going on, and a lot of uncertainty and a lot of fear. But very quickly, one factor became established, which meant that this was never going to have the proportions that the coronavirus did, which is AIDS can only be spread through intimate contact of one form or another. It is not an airborne disease. And all the difference in the world attaches to that. So if you have a situation with respect to AIDS, you could tell people, be careful with whom you have sexual relations. You can handle that on your own if you've got anything. But you can't do that with an airborne virus. And so the need for separation becomes much more powerful. And I do think, in effect, that it's extremely important, just as a basic primer, for somebody who's in charge of this thing to explain why this epidemic is so dangerous, how the thing spread, why it is that lesser restrictions don't work, in order to legitimize the really intensive sort of government controls that are going to be put into place. I mean, this is, you know, this is the real stuff when it comes to epidemic. All too often you hear, you know, oh, there's a terrible epidemic, too many obese people in the United States and so forth. You don't shut down airports for those kinds of reasons. What you really have to remember is, in this particular case, when we use the word epidemic, we're thinking of the Black Plague. We're thinking of something which is communicable and spreads very rapidly and is deadly in its consequences with respect to innocent people. And those are very narrow definitions, and they're very exacting requirements. And unfortunately, they're all satisfied in this particular case.
The last thing that I'll ask you, the outbreak of this virus has raised some questions about our supply chains in the U.S. for important medical products. So there was a report in Axios this last weekend that there are approximately 150 prescription drugs that the U.S. could face a shortage of if demand for them significantly increased in China. Hawley, the Republican senator from Missouri, is introducing legislation to try to bring more of that production back here. Richard, you and I have discussed in past episodes about trade, the argument you sometimes hear that certain goods are so vital to the country's welfare that you can't rely on getting them from overseas. Is this one of those areas? Is it important that the U.S. have its own production capacity on this front?
I think it's an impossibility. You're talking about a viral situation in which you have essentially a real crisis that's coming within the next month. To try to establish an independent capacity within anything close to that timeline is wildly improbable. I think that what you really need to do is to figure out how you pump in large amounts of public funds into a couple of companies that have real expertise in trying to deal with this viral situation. There is a really tricky financial issue that's associated with this, which is that when you start getting a worthy vaccine, you are genuinely creating a public good, because what's happening is that when you vaccinate one person, what you do is you reduce the probability that this virus is going to spread to somebody else who may not have been vaccinated. And if you try to simply rely on the profit motive of individual corporations to do this, and they know that they're going to come up with a virus which is going to have a huge sale for a grand total of 2 weeks, then they're not going to have enough money coming back out of the individual sales to cover the kinds of costs that they're going to have to incur to engage in this kind of a crash program. And since there's so many externalities that are involved of such a serious nature, the standard response, which says use public subsidies to offset those particular costs, is to my mind appropriate. So what I would do if I were Mr. Hawley is I would identify the 10 companies that are involved in this thing, try to give them hundreds of millions of dollars if that's what it takes in order to make this thing go. Try to have other companies release people who are biologists who know something about this to work on this particular aid and to subsidize it. How effective will that be? Nobody knows. But to try to create new supply chains and independent sources of this, that, and the other thing is a year-like operation. If it turns out that we have this serious problem, the market will to some extent in the long run respond to that by creating other kinds of ways to deal with it. Stockpiling, for example, might be one of the things that are used. But if you're trying to think about this thing in terms of a six-month to a year perspective, if you could increase the probability of getting a decent vaccine for this by even 2 weeks or a month, you can be saving billions upon billions of dollars and many, many lives to boot. And it seems to me that that's worth doing. As I said, one of the rules that you go back to Roman law, right, Troy? We always go back to Roman law because there is the following maxim, which is really true. The Romans used to say that the conditions of public necessity suspend property rights. And what they mean by that is the ordinary situation of exclusivity of property rights, development, and exchange, and so forth, don't work when the virus that you have is so utterly pervasive and so utterly dangerous, there's nothing that can stand in its way. And so at that particular point, what you do is you take ad hoc measures. They're going to be very deeply infringing on ordinary liberties. I think everybody understands that. They're going to involve all sorts of tax powers and things of that sort. And what you have to do is to make sure that you get the best people and the best arguments in order to do it. Trump is not perhaps everybody's ideal president, but he's the only one that we have. And I think what people really have to do is to get him to understand that whoever he puts in charge of this as a political matter has to have some very solid people with scientific credentials actually running the affairs on a day-to-day basis. This is something which is too important to be left to the vagaries of political differences and nasty partisan politics.
All right. You managed to sneak Roman law in there twice in 20 minutes. I hope you're sated, Richard.
I'm always satisfied.
Thanks to you, and thanks to our listeners. As always, remember, you can read Richard's column. It's called The Libertarian, and you can find it at defining ideas@hoover.org. And you can also follow him on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. And if you enjoy the podcast, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your downloads. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.